org or by asking your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much.
Bonjour, welcome to Native Lights where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Cole Primo. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Nicholas Deshaw, an Ojibwe father, author, and educator. Nicholas masterfully blends his Indigenous heritage with imaginative fiction across a wide range of genres, from sci-fi and horror to children's picture books. On our show, he shared his journey as a writer, discussing his latest projects that included a graphic novel and his first children's book, Loaf the Cat Goes to the Powwow. We spoke with him in October 2024. Enjoy.
I was in a pretty rough place in life at that time. I mean, I had some story ideas, and my wife told me, I think you just need to write. And that kind of floored me, honestly. To have someone who believed in what I was saying so much, to have someone who encouraged me and was like, no, go do this. Clearly, this is what you want. Clearly, you have a talent for this.
Bonjour, hello. Welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem.
And I'm your other host, Cole Primo. Meet Gwaich for joining us on Native Lights, a podcast and radio show. But it's more than that. At its core, it's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Each and every week, we have captivating conversations with a whole lot of great guests from different backgrounds. We're talking musicians, artists, community leaders, authors, educators, you name it. They have a wonderful mixture of passions. And we talk to them about their gifts and how they share those gifts with their community. And it centers around finding purpose in our lives and amplifying Native voices. So, Leah, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Hanging in there. How about you, Cole?
I'm doing great. I've got two things I want to say. One thing, I was able to see the Northern Lights in its full glory at our place in Stillwater, and it was an absolute treat, also known as Wawa Tay. So I had to look it up, the Ojibwe meaning behind it. Kind of means like glowing lights and spirits dancing with each other. It also reminded me of one of my other favorite words, Wawashkeshi, deer with the white tail dancing away. I like to, you know, learn a little lesson, but also it was a great experience. And the second thing was I got to listen to my sister's mini documentary or whatever you want to call it, but it was really great. Finding Manoman. Congratulations on all that. You're still working on a film version of it, but great job so far, sis.
Thank you very, very much. It was a long time coming.
Yeah, and it coincided with Indigenous Peoples Day, the release of it. Happy Indigenous Peoples Day. Very quickly, did you want to tell people how that all came together?
Yeah, so Finding Manoman, A Search for the Spirit of Wild Rice is a project done with NPR News, my employer, and I set out with a film crew to learn more about wild rice and just try to connect with the sacred plant. So we did a film and an audio companion piece, which is an hour long, and it features a song with me singing and you on guitar, Cole. That was really fun.
That was really fun. Great work and all that.
Thank you.
It was wonderful to hear, and I hope people check it out.
Did you listen to the whole thing?
Oh, you betcha. You betcha.
Oh, wow.
Didn't even take a break.
Enraptured.
No, it's good. All the different voices and having, Marvin, your son, my nephew. It was really great to hear him involved. And of course, old Willie.
Sweet Willie Wine.
Willie Wine, our dad. Sweet Willie Wine. So good stuff. Good stuff. But yeah, let's get to today's guest. So today we're excited to speak with Nicholas Deshaw of the Boys Fort Band of Chippewa. He lives in St. Paul and is an author who has written fiction for all ages, from sci-fi, which is one of my favorites, to horror, to picture books. He's greatly inspired by his Ojibwe culture, drawing much of his source material from it and focusing on creating more representation of Native people in his writing. So good to hear that. And he's also a father, educator, and traditional lacrosse coach. So can't wait to talk with him about all that and much more. And here he is. Bonjour, Nicholas.
Hey, bonjour.
Could you start out by introducing yourself, giving a little background, all that good stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I'm gay. I'm just a cause. I'm going to see you in a day. So I'm going to see you in a day. 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 So hi, everyone. I'm Nicholas Ashaw, Bimbatutumishtim. I'm Eagle Clan, voice for Ojibwe. I live in St. Paul, but I was born and grew up through my youth in Michigan, actually. I am also a writer and educator, and I am just super psyched to be here today. I've been a fan of this show since season one, day one, been following you guys.
Nice.
Wow.
One of the OG listeners. I like
hey.
It. That's great. Awesome. Well, thank you for joining us. We also like to ask, how are you doing? How's the family?
Family's good. It's a really busy time of the year. You know, as we ramp up to kind of the height of fall, I suppose. There's a lot going on. I've got two children. They're wonderful. They're 4 and 5 months. So all of the challenges that come with a young family, but all the joys as well.
What's keeping you busy?
What's not keeping you busy? I mentioned I have two children, right? I said that, yeah.
It's the sarcasm in my voice, like coming through there. I can't imagine.
Yeah, right. Exactly. No, but I'm a writer too. I've got 4 writing projects I'm kind of in the midst of at the moment.
That'll do it. As you know, we like to ask every person who comes and shares time with us, what are you thinking about these days?
I just really think about how, especially as I raise a family, the kinds of media my children are engaging with and the kinds of media I wish existed. And some of it does exist and plenty of it doesn't exist. And so I'm just always thinking about more ways to create indigenized, decolonized media around language and culture, especially just more kinds of media out there. That's something I think about a lot.
I love it. Well, thanks for doing that. I know I have a young one and boy, if he can get some indigenous media going, I'm all for it.
Yeah, absolutely. There's more than ever, but it's still a tiny sliver of what's out there.
Mm-hmm.
Including getting some Native representation in graphic novels, right?
Yeah.
Had to throw that in there to transition to some of your projects.
Yeah, I've been a big fan of comics and graphic novels for a long time. And I've seen very, very few that I really enjoyed. Like I really felt had a good representation of Native people. So I'm partnering right now with Coyote and Crow Games to create a new graphic novel for them. We're ironing out a lot of details on that, but we're hoping to launch it on Kickstarter at some point. If you're not familiar with Coyote and Crow, it's this really cool concept of what if the colonization of the Americas never happened and technology has advanced to just kind of like really far levels, super sci-fi levels. And then there was also this event that happened where like this asteroid or meteor came across the earth and like sprinkled across this kind of strange power that some people are gifted with and gives them certain supernatural abilities. I mean, the possibilities of storytelling, they are just so ripe. It's a whole tabletop RPG. So, you know, think Dungeons and Dragons. You know, instead of playing in a medieval European setting, you're playing in a sci-fi, futuristic, indigenous American setting. And it's all a Native team that are creating this graphic novel. And then most of the comic, the game itself, Coyote and Crow, was developed by indigenous team founders. Conor Alexander is an awesome dude. He's Cherokee. Very, very passionate about this kind of stuff. And I've been a huge fan of his since it started. So it's a huge honor to be invited to work with him on this project. And hopefully we'll have more solid news soon. But it's coming together in some cool ways behind the scenes right now.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Nicholas Deshaw, an Ojibwe author, father, and educator. Nicholas masterfully blends his Indigenous heritage with imaginative fiction across a wide range of genres. We spoke with him in October 2024. Enjoy.
So what if colonization of Turtle Island never happened, plus superpowers? But like, what goes on in your mind to like build that story from 500 years ago or whenever it starts? What happens next or what doesn't happen?
I'll start with what I try not to do. I've had great conversations with a lot of people. Lately, my friend, Dr. Melanie Yazzie, who works in American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota, who I get to work with, we've had a lot of cool conversations about sci-fi fantasy genre fiction and how it tends to be really just fictionalized, fantastical versions of colonization in the end. You know, you think Star Wars, and like, we all love Star Wars, but like, it's a colonial story. Maybe one reason why a lot of these stories really resonate with Indigenous people is because it's so often this ragtag group of rebels fighting against this all-powerful evil empire. It's like, yeah, that's just like Tuesday for us, right? Like, you know? So it's considering very closely, how do I tell a story that is not informed by colonization, or if it is informed, then I'm very intentional about that. I'm deciding to comment on colonization in this story in this particular way. Like with the graphic novel I mentioned, that's one thing I really think about a lot. Like, okay, well, that's not a context in this world. Then what I try to do instead is focus on relationships. I think in the heart of a lot of storytelling in the West is conquest, is, you know, you save the empire, you save the world, and you get the guy, you get the girl at the end, and it wraps up with kiss and everything's peaceful and stuff. You know, that's fine. But what other kind of relationships can we explore when that's not the problem that you're dealing with? And thinking of the world in terms of not power structures and not products, but relationships.
Awesome. Awesome. From what I'm seeing, you have a variety of writings. So you're working on this graphic novel, but you also do children's books.
So my first children's book that's out right now is called Loaf the Cat Goes to the Powwow. A really, really cool opportunity that I had. Penguin Random House had a number of their imprints who were seeking Indigenous writers to create different kinds of children's literature. And I had a few things I sent to them, different publication houses. They all said, thanks, but no. But one person, Nancy Paulson, who has published another Minnesota Ojibwe author recently, I believe, said, you know, this, what you sent me is more middle grade YA, but if you ever get a kid's picture book, let me know. I'd be curious. I'm like, cool, give me a few hours and let me see what I come up with. And so Loaf the Cat is based off of my wife's cat, and now my cat. Her name is Sophia, and her nickname was Loaf, because how cats kind of tuck their feet under themselves, look like a little loaf of bread. It's just cute how they do that. Again, I was thinking of, okay, what's a character that people could relate to? Well, most people like cats, or at least enjoy the antics that cats get up to. Cool. And then thinking, okay, what's something that's a really good representation of contemporary Indigenous culture? Well, the powwow, right? Like, that's such a big part of modern Indigenous cultures. Let me tell a story featuring a cat about a powwow that can hopefully be something that kids from multiple places can relate to. So the story follows Loaf. We see things from Loaf's perspective as she tells us about her life and her world and stuff. She has a boy. His name is Charlie. And he's putting together his grass dance regalia to go to dance at his first powwow. And it's her seeing how he puts this together, playing with the ribbons like cats like to do. And then suddenly he's gone. She takes a nap and he's gone. And where is he? Ah! And so she has to track him down. And she eventually, without telling too much, finds her way to the powwow and learns about powwow. The idea with this was, A, that non-Indigenous kids could enjoy this book from the perspective of Loaf. She's learning as they might be learning. And two, Native kids could see themselves in our main human character, who is going to powwow. And that's just a normal thing that he does. It's just part of what his family does. And it's not this strange or exotic or like totally unique out there thing that's like, oh, wow, what an interesting cultural experience we're having. Like, no, it's just, this is what we do. And this is who we are. And I really wanted to have that present. And the other thing that was actually a challenge was making sure Loaf never talks. Because in our traditional Ojibwe stories, if there's a talking animal, it's generally a sacred story or a story with protocols around it to be told in a certain way at a certain time. And so I was really careful, like, this is not going to be a talking animal story. And the other reason, too, because, like, those stories in a lot of Indigenous traditions are not just cutesy kid stories. They're stories with a lot of power, a lot of meaning, a lot of depth. And I didn't want to downplay any of that. So I made sure Loaf never talked. And that was a challenge. Again, we see things from her perspective, but she's not speaking. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to write. I learned a lot about publishing. Books take a long time. It took 3 years between when I wrote it and when it came out, which I didn't realize it was that long, but that's pretty normal. I have another book that I wrote that will be out in 2026 with the same publisher. It's on Ojibwe horses, actually. So I'm excited about that one, but it'll be a few years.
Do you find children's books to be more demanding?
It does come with a lot of challenges. A lot of people think like, oh, I could do that. It's just this cute little story or whatever. I'm like, okay, well, give it a go. Like, you know, maybe you can, but you might find it's harder than you think. The real challenge is that it's so short. Most children's picture books that come out these days are less than 1,000 words. That's less than 2 pages of text. You have to tell a story with a clear beginning, middle, and end that keeps you interested and engaged the whole way. And that's hard. So really, I think keeping a tight focus is important. Children don't have a lot of depth. They don't have a lot of life experience. So they don't have a long-term attention span. So keeping it sharp, keeping it tight, and keeping it as relatable as you can to them, while maybe pushing them to consider something new, something they haven't seen before, or a perspective they haven't had. I believe children's literature should always be teaching something.
Great, great. All right, well, let's take a step back. Like, what set you down the path that you're on? Like, what inspired your passion for writing?
I remember being an elementary kid liking to write stories and draw comics, even though I learned I'm not a drawer later on. I love the way a story can take you when you are just so immersed in a story that nothing else exists. If you're a big reader, you probably have moments you can remember where you were reading a story that you really loved and then something happened and it blew your mind or it shocked you completely. And you remember that moment very crystal clear. For me, it was when Dumbledore died in Harry Potter. Spoilers. That was like, oh. And I think it was really when I was in my earlier 20s, I realized that I just love story and I want to create stories. I want to create them. And I didn't think I could do it for some reason. I knew I could do it, but I didn't really think I could do it like on any kind of like serious level until my wife really encouraged me to jump into it. I was in a pretty rough place in life at that time. I mean, I had some story ideas and my wife told me, I think you just need to write. And that kind of floored me, honestly, to have someone who believed in what I was saying so much, to have someone who encouraged me and was like, no, go do this. Clearly, this is what you want. Clearly, you have a talent for this. And to this day, my wife, Kateri, is my number one in everything, but definitely in my writing. Loaf the Cat would never have happened without her. That's true for most of my stories. My writing career would never have happened without her.
Wives can be very great when it comes to encouragement. I know that firsthand.
We're lucky men.
Exactly. So what experiences have you had with people who've read the children's books?
I'm still definitely starting on that path. Loaf only came out in May, so it's been not quite 6 months. But I've been able to do a number of readings. A number of people have, in my circles, have bought the book, have given me feedback. I got to go do a reading at my son's preschool. You had his teacher, Miss Janice LaFleau, on a little while ago. That was so exciting. I got to read this story, and I had all these little Native kids who were just like eyes on me, listening so closely, really engaged. And that was just like, that's why I'm doing this. This is who this is for. This is why I created this. And I was able to give a copy to every kid in his class. I think every artist will tell you, and I know you two are musicians, but like anything you create, there's a piece of you in that. And so for someone to say like what you built, what you made, what's out there resonate with me and mean something to me too, as the person who created it, who it means so much too, like, I mean, that's everything, right? Like that's why you do it. When you create a piece of art, book, a song, a movie, whatever, a painting, it's now the world's. It's now the people who receive it. And whatever they do with it, that's done. You don't have any control of that. You don't have any say. And your opinion even at that point, or your intentions even at that point, kind of don't matter. Or don't matter as much as they did. Maybe I'll get some pushback from people on that. But I really do feel like that resonates with me at least. How these things can change. And like even if you had an intention, like Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam created a song and he may have meant it to be this really dark song. And then people interpret it as this like really hopeful song. And he's like, I guess I could see that. And he said like the meaning changed for him because of that. You know, that wasn't the reason he wrote it. I really appreciate that. I saw this interview recently with Donald Glover to Erykah Badu. And he talks about wanting people to get what he's trying to say in his music. And she says like, your job is just create something you love. And it's not on you what they do with it or how they consume it. Like, you just feed them. Again, those things really resonated with me. I want to create something that resonates. I want to create something that people can really love, brings a smile or moves them in a way. How they are moved is on them. And I'd love to hear it because maybe it's in ways I never expected. And I actually think as an artist, as creative, like that's that much more powerful because you don't know what you're creating. And that's as beautiful in some ways as sitting down with a blank page and creating something totally new, whole cloth. The reaction that you never expect or intended is just as thrilling and exciting as creating the story itself in the first place.
Yeah, you don't get to throw your art out into the world with like little explainers. Even when I go to an art gallery, I'm a little casual. And I don't necessarily read all the little explanations on the piece of paper next to each art piece. I'm just like, you know, I see the art piece first. I have a feeling towards it. And that input comes second.
Yeah.
And it doesn't change that initial feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the value, though, too, is if you ever get to meet that artist, you know, and you can talk about that, like your experience with them and swap kind of creative stories.
Awesome. Talk a little bit about, you know, who inspired you, like mentors along the way, besides, you know, the Native Lights crew.
Yeah, Native Lights, number one. Everything starts there. Yeah, like the primo siblings. Yeah. No, I'm honestly, I am honestly inspired by you guys. I love what you're doing. I was able to go through a mentorship program through All My Relations Arts for writers, and it was led by Art Colson, who's a local guy. He's Cherokee, so he's kind of a transplant to Minnesota, but has become a bigger name in Native Lit, and especially Native Kid Lit in the area. And he was just so generous with his knowledge to all of us, but he really, I felt, took me under his wing and has given me a ton of opportunities that I never would have had. And that's the thing too, like, we all stand on the shoulders of giants. Nothing is created in a vacuum. We all have the opportunities we have because someone gave it to us. I think also for other creatives that really stand out to me in comics, big one is Sloan Leong, and her multiple books have been really, really fantastic. Demi Macheras and Casey Silver of 80% Studios, I consider them friends, and also they inspire me in their work. Marlon James, actually, the novelist, former local guy, his books, Black Leopard, Red Wolf, and Spider King are incredible. Ta-Nehisi Coates' run on Black Panther was really, really incredible. And then the Silver Surfer run with The Death of Silver Surfer, which is a kind of side story, like non-canon, non-in-universe story by Straczynski, was also just one of the greatest pieces of literature I've ever read. And some of his run on Spider-Man 2 is also very, very good, though he's a bit of a controversial figure in that world, but I think his writing is excellent. You know, one person also I really need to shout out to is kind of an early supporter of mine from college, my former professor, Linda Lagarde Grover. She was someone who really praised my writing, even though my writing that she saw at the time was for her classes. She was such a kind person, such a mentor to me at that time, and has continued to support and promote my work, even as she's launched into the stratosphere of just literature period, let alone Native literature. You know, she's also just a really, really great person.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Nicholas Deshaw, an Ojibwe author, father, and educator. Nicholas masterfully blends his Indigenous heritage with imaginative fiction across a wide range of genres. We spoke with him in October 2024. Enjoy.
Kind of random question, which I've never asked before. What is your reading to writing ratio with time?
Ooh.
What would you estimate that to be?
Like how much I read versus how much I write kind of thing?
Yeah.
I'd say it's about 2 to 1. Twice as much reading to half as much writing.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to do that because you need to immerse in so much stuff. Another author I forgot to mention is Gene Wolfe, who I got to meet. I actually recorded the last interview he ever gave before he passed away. Yeah, if you look on YouTube, Gene Wolfe fan interview, you'll find it. He's a voracious reader. And these days, I have to find more ways to read. So I've actually really switched to audiobooks. 20-minute commute to work, perfect for getting through audiobook. I usually listen to it on double speed just because I want to read so much more. You know, being constantly exhausted, having young children, to sit down with a book actually is very, very tiring these days in a way it never used to be. But so audiobooks are great. But yeah, I think I wind up probably listening / reading twice as much as I wind up writing. Maybe one day that'll change, but you know, I got a full-time day job for now. It's not writing yet.
What's the writing process like? Do you have to find like a spot in your house or, you know, home to do it? Or is it just anywhere you can find? Or do you write on a notepad? Do you write on a computer? What do you do?
I write on whatever the hell I can get my hands on, man. Like, usually it's on my phone or my computer, but it's probably more my phone. And like, I don't prefer that, but it's like, if I'm holding a sleeping baby and I know that I'm going to be stuck there for an hour and a half and I've got this idea or I have a deadline, I need to make, let's go thumbs. Let's see if we can bang out here real quick. Like if I had a word count for how much I typed with just my thumbs on my phone, I'd probably, I don't know, blush a little bit. I prefer my computer. It's just not always practical. And the other thing too, like I say this to people who struggle with finding writing time, who are maybe trying to get started or whatever. Any writing you do is enough. Check. You've done it. I had a time when back in 2020, yeah, we were on lockdown, everything was slowed down and stuff, but I had my first child at that point, and he was the baby. And that's hard. So I would find I'd have a little time in the morning, depending on how long he was okay being in his crib. before he'd want to be picked up. It could be 5 minutes, it could be 30 minutes. And whatever I got done, I told myself I would be okay with that. Whatever the amount that was, whether it was a sentence, whether it was 10 pages, I would be like, okay, if I can do more, great. But I've written today, I have created, feel good about that. You have achieved it, check. I always tell people that because whatever you do is enough, especially if you're just getting started, just get something on paper in a document, in a e-document of some kind, however you have to do it. Yeah, be a nut for it, man. Bulldog, sink your teeth into it. Don't let go.
Love it.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time. We like to end the chat with final thoughts, anything that you'd like to mention that we hadn't brought up.
Yeah.
Sometimes I like to ask what advice you'd give to somebody trying to, get into writing, get into, creating books, all that stuff.
Cool. Yeah. I think I'd say for not just writing, but anyone in creativity, just start making. Make whatever. Doesn't matter if it's good. Doesn't matter if it's bad. Just make it, because once it's made, it exists and it can be improved on. Your first draft doesn't count, as another cliche out there. But now you have a first draft, so you can develop it. And it's not just, oh yeah, it's in my head, whatever. It doesn't have to be writing. Whether you want to do music, whether you want to do film, just create something, put it out there, and you will improve. And I think also just be really, really open to any opportunities you can. If you're trying to get published, if you're trying to get a recording deal or whatever else, put yourself in spaces where you're going to hear about those things. With my first writing deal, I was in I was in a lot of writing groups just on social media. And that's where I saw that they were looking for that. So I was putting myself in places where those opportunities pop up. And that's just grown. I've developed my network. So also develop your network. Spend time with other creative people. Spend time with people who have done the things that you want to do as much as you can. Go to events where those things are happening. And just learn. Be voracious. For a long time, I would spend hours every week watching YouTube videos on how to create a scene, how to write, what a good character arcs look like, all that kind of stuff. So just always be hungry, always be hunting. And then also be kind to yourself. Like I said a second ago, you've created, you've done well, and internalize that as much as you internalize criticism. Internalize that I have achieved something. I've created something. I've done it. I'm doing it.
I want to take that bit of audio and make it a ringtone.
I need to listen to that more. Like just being happy with what you create. Sometimes I'm way too critical about everything I do. Well, Chimi, great for your time, Nicholas. Really appreciate it.
Thanks. You guys too. Thanks again for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm ready to create again.
Exactly. I know. I want to grab the guitar and play some stuff right after this.
Just go.
Get it recorded. Get it on the record, Good stuff. All right. Well, thank you to our guest, Nicholas Deshaw, an Anishinaabe author. He lives in St. Paul and he writes for all ages and draws from his Ojibwe culture. I'm Cole Primo.
And I'm Leah Lem. Miigwech for listening. Gigawabamin.
Gigawabamin.
You're listening to Native Lights, Where Indigenous Voices Shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
KEXE was first on the air in 1976. Recently, a couple of the founders, Rich and Susie McClear, stopped by to talk about why KEXE was needed then.
A lot of people were up here thinking they were doing their own thing. And when the radio station came on the air, they found a neighbor was doing the same thing, or somebody across town. And it magically became there are a lot of us up here that have the same thoughts, the same activities.
Neighbors talking to neighbors. We help them get in contact with each other and talk to each other about common problems.
KEXE is still needed now. We're connected through green cheese trivia, through great music and events. We're in crisis mode. We have had all of our funding cut from the federal government. Please help us out. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you so much for your support.
Turn your radio on.
It is time for KAXC Rewind, a look on the weekends at some of the interesting conversations we've had on our morning show. I'm Heidi Holton.
I'm Jennifer Barr.
It's been quite a whirlwind week.
Yes, we chose our question of the week kind of based off an interview we had the week prior with Brian Arala from MinnPost about rural grocery stores. So we've been asking you, what do you remember about grocery stores from when you were young?
Yeah.
And boy, have we gotten responses.
Well, I knew, okay, so I've known you a long time. I knew this would be really interesting for you because you, and your family, I mean, generations are tied to grocery stores. You worked in them and, you know, I've heard your stories over the years. But I didn't really know if I had anything I would think of with it. And I did not realize how many people, like, there's just something about, it must be about going with family, being in a small town.
The smells.
Yeah.
Especially like that smoky meat smell in certain stores.
Right.
And we've had grandparent stories. I remember how special it felt to go shopping with my grandparents, mm-hmm. even though like, it wasn't that different, but somehow it was.
It felt exotic, didn't
yeah.
it? To go, like if I'd go to the city and be with my grandma and to go to a different grocery store.
Yeah. You and know? Like, it just felt so different. And of course, grandma might buy you a special treat.
Oh, yeah. One of the things that it was fun because sometimes I'm lucky enough that my brother, who's 5 years older, listens in when I'm on the air. And, you know, I remember what I was telling you about my grandma would eat the grapes and that she was just real freewheeling kind of lady anyway. But he had this distinct memory of being put in the shopping cart in the front, and that like they'd walk in and she'd go right to the cookie department and they would get Hydrox cookies because he said they were cheaper mm-hmm. than the Oreos. And then his text to me said, and we ate them as we shopped. I'm like, we, that's the part I love about that. It wasn't just for
yeah.
the kid. And the grapes and all of that kind of stuff. So,
which the cookies you can pay for after
you
the
sure
fact.
Can. Grapes, not so much.
Yeah.
But if you eat 5 grapes, no big whoop, right?
Yeah. What is that, like an ounce?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know. But it's been fun. Family stories, community stories. One of the ones that stands out the most was from longtime member of KEXE, Carrie Thorvig. I'm surprised I didn't think of her immediately because I knew she came from a grocery store family and that it still exists.
Yeah, it does. It's gone through a lot of changes. She sent us this note. I fondly remember the small corner grocery store my parents bought the year my older brother was born. I remember the one checkout, the narrow, creaky stairs up to my dad's office where he always had a bag of candy in the bottom desk drawer, often Rolos. I remember Chuck, the meat man in the small meat room. Then he built a new store when I was about 5, I think. That building underwent many renovations and was the place of my childhood. I'd ride bike in the parking lot on Sunday evenings when my dad went in to close the store. I remember sitting utterly scared in the front of the store by myself in a storm when the power went out. I remember Anita, who worked in produce, wrapping lettuce. We played hide and seek in the back room among the boxes stacked up high. At this store, I spent many hours after school waiting for my parents to pick me up with employees who were like family, offering me rides home way before cell phone days. My mom always pointed out that I was safe and had plenty of food. The biggest and most important memory for me of growing up in a grocery store was not the food shows, though they were fun, with lots of free swag and all the samples you could want. It was not the times I remember watching Alice, Betty, and Peggy make beautiful hand-lettered signs for the sale items each week. It was not the store parties at Christmas or the post-highway cleanup gatherings. The most important part of the grocery store for me growing up was the way that employees and coworkers became like family. I was surrounded by so many loving, caring adults through my childhood. I learned about loyalty, respect, hard work, and pride in a job well done. My dad was a good man who treated his employees well, and they, in turn, were loyal. He always wanted to be the best for them, even if it meant them moving on to other ventures. Both of my parents are now gone, and the old store building sold. After my dad lost his battle to cancer at the age of 60, my brother took over the business and built a new, bigger store. When he was getting it set up, my boys and I went for a visit, and the cousins played hide-and-seek in the empty aisles and half-filled shelves. Grocery stores are much more than a place to buy food in small towns. For many, they are the heart of the town, providing employment, field trip opportunities for school children, and a supporter of school and community events. There is nothing like a small town grocery store.
That was our question of the week, and this truly embodied a question of the week on KEXE because we just all felt connected and included in these stories. There's something about it and sharing them. So you can certainly still text in your stories of grocery stores. I'm sure Carrie's evoked some memories from folks. You can text 218-326-1234. While we're on the morning show, we heard on Friday from Finn Billy from Smoky Hills. His story was, I remember in 1967, I was 10 years old and my father would send me to the dairy store, which was a few blocks away in South Minneapolis. I would buy him 2 6-packs of Hams beer and a carton of Camel Straights and bring them home. Later that year, they gave me my first job, which was to sweep the floor and mop the floor, bring in the newspapers, stack them for sale, flatten cardboard boxes and price goods with the sticker stamper. I was paid cash, of course. Did you have to use the sticker? You were at checkout.
Yeah, we had UPC codes by that point.
Okay.
So it was scanning things, but we had to memorize the PLU codes.
Sure.
Price lookup for produce. Bananas was $3.14.
How about apples?
It depended on the kind of apples, but it started with a 3. All our fruits started with 3. veggies started with 7. Broccoli, 7.06. So you sometimes, it depended on the produce. You either weighed them and had to enter that number or per item.
Okay, sure.
You know, so there was a way to do it. Our cash registers were fairly primitive for the time that we were in.
Mm-hmm.
I know they have since been updated. Other stores, like when my mom worked at the Super Value in Mora in the 1970s, she was having to enter each and every price in the cash register.
Oh, wow.
You know, and marking things.
It did. I do remember it took a lot longer
to check out.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was also very fun. There was just something like that moving belt, like when you were a little kid and seeing that whole thing happen. And
yeah,
it was kind of a weird, magical thing. And I think part of what's appealing to all of us about this is that, you know, life has changed so much. There is corporate ownership of lots of things. And so you don't get to have some of those small town grocery stores we were used to. I remember going into town, into Brainerd, with one of my friends whose grandparents lived in Northeast Brainerd, which I was never in that area before. And there was just a little tiny grocery store there that we would just walk down and buy some candy. And that was smaller than I had been in before. That's like 2 aisles,
mm-hmm.
you know, but had enough stuff. I mean, basically a convenience store without gas, but it was right next to the beautiful school that's there, Harrison School. And the building is still there. And honestly, I think like even 10 years ago, I think there was some sort of store, kind of a grocery store
mm-hmm.
in there. People will probably tell me differently. And I just hope that.
Yeah.
Small town grocery stores, doesn't have to be small town. You know, people are also got memories that they grew up in cities, but of maybe olden days, I guess. And part of this is to talk about the difference in the world. We'll be hearing coming up a conversation with our MinnPost reporter we talked with recently about more of the economics of small town grocery stores and then also what it means to rural people when things consolidate or your store is shut down and you have to go 30, 40 miles to buy groceries, especially fresh groceries, and maybe you don't have transportation. It becomes a big barrier to living in rural places.
Right. And the employment it offers in that MinnPost story, there was a great photo of 2 young guys working at Zups.
Yep.
And just reminded me of the people I worked with. We had a lot of high school kids in that store working. And some towns don't have a lot of other opportunities. There's not all the fast food restaurants or other places to work. And it's a great starting point for people. And some people make it a career. My mom worked in high school and into her early 20s in a grocery store. And then she took a break from that for a bit and then went back to it for 23 more years. So
I have never asked you this. Did you have to wear a uniform or an apron or anything?
Yes, we had what we called smocks.
Oh, sure.
Which are like a little jacket.
Yeah.
Maroon colored. And you could button it up if you wanted to. The teenagers never wanted to button it up. That was what the checkout people wore. When I first started at Yankee Foods, the bag boys had to wear white shirts with ties.
Wow.
And then they had green aprons that went over them where they could, like, you know, keep their box cutter and things.
Snappy. That sounds great.
But, that later changed. They got polo shirts with the store's logo on them instead later on. But yeah, I remember the need for ties for those young boys.
Yeah. We heard one of the people we heard from as well said he grew up in Aurora. This was from Rick. He said the grocery store there was Potachnik's. I remember riding in the cart. We stopped at the meat counter and the butcher would give me a homemade hot dog to eat on the spot, and it was cold. I can remember the snap of fresh casing when I bit into it.
I remember getting samples of like meat, like little, you know, they cut sausages into like coins with a toothpick. And there's our sample lady, Florence.
Sure, of course.
Who would be there at certain times. And it was always a great day if there was samples in the store.
We've probably brought up memories for you. We hope you are also sharing some stories with us through our text line, 218-326-1234. There's so many other like auxiliary issues where this has gone as well, like the stamps where you could get free stuff by shopping there, mm-hmm. the green stamps and all of that. So.
There would be products sometimes you could buy. I got a set of Snoopy encyclopedias that like each week there'd be the new book you could get.
Cool stuff. Coming up, listen to that conversation with our MinnPost reporter about small town grocery stores. This is KAXE Rewind. I'm Heidi Holton.
I'm Jennifer Barr.
This Thursday morning show here on KAXE, that's Heidi Holton. I'm Malachi Coons. Thank you for tuning in.
Today, we've been checking in with rural journalists, including the KAXE newsroom. Our next story is about the importance of grocery stores, food insecurity in rural places, and changes from the federal government on reporting of hunger. Grocery stores, as we all know, can be really a hub of communities, but times have changed. Malachi, you grew up in a pretty small town in yep. Wisconsin. Do you remember the grocery stores there as something special?
Yep, absolutely. I, was the youngest. I was at home with my mom. She was not working when I was little, and you know, I just remember going to the grocery store all the time, knowing the names of the bagger. There's this guy named Chad. He still works there. He was always so thrilled to see me and kind of knew him throughout my life, this guy. I eventually ended up working there in high school. But in my town, we had a co-op, we had the grocery store, and then later on, we had Walmart, where you could also buy groceries. And I think right around the time, it was an institution, but by the time I went left to college, a larger chain of grocery stores had gobbled up the small local one. And then I think now they've all closed.
Mm.
Now there's an Aldi and a Walmart. So there, you know, there's more options than rural places, but,
yeah.
you know, even in that, my lifetime went from small one, larger local chain, gobbled it up. That one then closed.
Yeah.
So now there's Walmart, Aldi, and a co-op.
It changes communities. We're excited now to have with us for the first time from MinnPost, Brian Arala. And he has done this intensive in-depth article in MinnPost about, it's called Many Minnesotans Already Live Miles from Their Nearest Grocery Store. What happens if it closes? Brian, welcome to KAXE.
Hi, Heidi. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Okay, so this story you've done is part of the Rural News Network initiative from the Institute for Nonprofit News. Let's start with the personal. Did you're hearing Malachi talk about his small town remembrances of grocery stores. Who'd you meet? How'd you find these grocery stores right now?
Well, yeah, him talking about growing up in a small town. I grew up in Chisholm, Minnesota, and my first job was actually at a grocery store at yep. Jubilee Foods, which is still around. So this reporting this story brought back some memories from those times.
Ours was also called Jubilee. Sorry, I had to throw that in there.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Small world. yeah, but for this story, which is called, or this project, which is called Sowing Resilience, we looked at food insecurity. And so my angle for it was looking at rural grocery stores, just knowing the role that they play in communities. And I was looking for communities that are small towns that are far away from the next closest option. And two places in northwest Minnesota popped up, and then one in northeast Minnesota. So I made the loop, long road trip to visit these communities, hear from the grocers, and found out they had really interesting stories and really central roles in their small towns.
Did you still see that there was a lot of community in these small grocery stores? Like that was sort of, not necessarily you're hanging out, but you know people and you kind of share the news of the community when you're shopping.
Absolutely. And you use the word hub, and it's a hub in more than one way, not just food access, but the bulletin board, the people coming in and seeing what's new and sharing the latest update. So it was very apparent right away when I was in these that people who walk through the door are familiar faces, maybe even distant family members of the people. And so there's a very tight-knit aspect to it where it's more than just a grocery store and a place to get food. It's also a meeting place and a place to stay connected with the rest of your community.
Yeah. What are some of the challenges that these places that they are facing that is kind of causing this for these ones that still have a small one, but what are the long-term challenges that they are facing?
Yeah, rising costs always, inflation, costly equipment. So if a refrigeration unit goes down, that's not an easy fix always. It's multiple thousands of dollars to do that. And you can't always predict, even though equipment failures tend to happen eventually. You don't know when it'll happen. Or there are already tight margins, so that's a tough one. And then growing competition and consolidation, which you touched on a bit ago, Malachi. And then upcoming cuts to nutrition assistance programs won't help either, because that just can further cut into those narrow profit margins.
So this isn't just a story about like local businesses in small towns. This is also about access to food. Can you talk about that aspect of it?
Yeah, so these stores, which are in Grigla, Greenbush, and Cook, all of them are examples where if that store isn't around, people are going to be traveling longer distances to get food. And there's quality of life and cost impacts related to that. So it wouldn't be that uncommon to find stores in Minnesota where 50 miles round trip is realistic to get to the next closest place, maybe even more to get to a thing that's most comparable to what they had. You may have a closer option at another quicker convenience store, dollar store, those kind of things, but it won't have all the options, the produce, the meat, all that stuff that you can get. So that's really the difference, is you lose that personal touch of local stores, but also the long drive you would face, and that changes, especially in Minnesota. We know winters get really, really brutal in some parts of the state in particular, and you don't want to venture out when you're short on groceries or have that essential item you need when there's a bad blizzard going and you got to go 30 miles.
And you can't just hop a bus to go 30 miles, you know, so you have to have that access to transportation on your own to be able to do that. Otherwise, you're facing food that, you know, maybe from a convenience store where you're not getting much fresh food that could really impact your health as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It ties into those other aspects of rural access gaps with transportation, and we see similar issues with healthcare, where if you have to travel further for that, it changes your quality of life. So it really ties into those other issues as well.
I was talking to Heidi earlier this morning that, you know, I have heard about food insecurity and heard about food deserts earlier in my life. It was often in the context of like neighborhoods within a big city where they have, you know, less access to cars. So it's really interesting to see this through the rural perspective. Yeah, what, you know, you talked about growing up in Chisholm. What really inspired you to dig into food insecurity in these more remote rural places?
Yeah, this came to mind pretty quickly when the Rural News Network put out a call for pitches from nonprofit newsrooms around the country. And there are eight others that are producing stories that are also really, really good to check out and have different angles to this topic. But what brought it to mind for me was previous reporting when I worked at the Mankato Free Press for 9 years before coming to MinnPost to cover Greater Minnesota. And we covered a Mankato, but a little bit of the wider region. And there was a store that started out, I believe, as a hardware store in a very small town south of Mankato. And they transitioned to also add grocery options. And it was because the town did not have anything like that. So people were having to go out of town to 20 miles plus to the next place. And it was a big deal. That community had not had a grocery option locally for a very long time. And so that came to mind, that I remembered reporting on that previously. And it got me thinking, where else are there places like this that have these sort of hubs in their radius that still do these things and are really big for their community. So past reporting really came in handy, and it didn't take too long to find good examples of stores that meet these criteria and would be interesting to highlight.
We're talking this morning with MinPost reporter Brian Arla, and we're learning more about the story, the in-depth story that he's done on rural grocery stores, food insecurity. Now, it seems like some of the issues that we are facing are also tied, of course, to the federal government and what's happening with the federal government. You talked about food stamps or SNAP benefits, and also kind of linking hunger and how the federal government is sort of changing things. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you found out there?
Yeah, so many, as I'm going around the state and looking into issues in greater Minnesota, a recurrent theme I would say is wondering what at the local level is being impacted by decisions at the federal level, how it's kind of being felt on the ground. And one of those is these supplemental nutrition assistance program changes, which are likely to make it a little bit more difficult to receive those benefits. And many grocery stores get a chunk of their revenue from those, so there's going to be an impact if fewer people can use that. And then also what tied directly into this story this week was the change to data reporting by the federal government on food insecurity. So the Associated Press, as part of this story, compiled data on food insecurity for every county that all of our newsrooms were working on, so we could understand and put in context, here's the percentage of people who are experiencing food insecurity in each of these counties. Now, that data will no longer be available after October, apparently, and so that's going to make it a lot more challenging to understand what's going on in real time on the ground. And that's happening at the same time as we may start to get closer and closer to experiencing what these SNAP cuts will do and the impact they'll have.
So, Brian, you mentioned, you know, growing up in Chisholm and the grocery store there, and then these grocery stores you visited. So you probably came into this story kind of thinking you might know what was going on. Did anything surprise you along the way?
What surprised me was growing up in Chisholm is about 4,000 to 5,000 people. So it's a small town, but you realize by going to some of these other communities how big Chisholm is compared to them. So it became very clear as I was getting into these communities that these can be quite remote, and so there's a tight-knitness there to the community, and you get a sense of, yeah, this is how far someone would have to go, and this is how big of a deal having a store locally versus not is. Grigla is a very small community, and they would go quite a ways to the next closest place. In Chisholm, it's still a big deal to have a local grocery store. You wouldn't have to go quite as far, but it would make an impact. But that was quite clear. And also the welcoming of these folks in these communities was really, really clear early on. They seemed really, really happy that someone was visiting their community and wanting to hear about their story and highlighting their local store that they love so much.
Yeah, that is wonderful. Before we let you go, Brian, we were talking all morning with rural reporters from our very own Larissa Donovan, we chatted with earlier, a reporter here at KXC. We're going to be talking with Aaron Brown, who reports for the Star Trib on different Iron Range issues. Just to you as a journalist, what's the importance of having reporters and stories about rural places in Minnesota?
Well, I come from a local news background. I worked at the Hibbing Daily Tribune first coming out of college for a couple of years, and then Mankato Free Press for nine. So coming from local news background, I'm always trying to champion and tout the work of local journalists, because I know there's such great work going on all around the state, and it's sometimes unsung work, but they're the folks who are going to the city council meetings, and like in Black Duck, I heard earlier for that issue, and school board meetings and all these things that are affecting people at a local level. There's just, those are irreplaceable to me. So I'm a big champion of local news, and think that the best part of my job is visiting communities around the state and talking to people and trying to bring those stories to the MinPost audience, so that no matter where you are, you understand your neighbor in Minnesota better.
MinPost reporter Brian Arla, Read the full story at minpost.com. Brian, it was great to talk to you. Hope to do it again soon.
Yeah, thanks, Brian.
Thanks very much.
Shop happily. I came in here for a special offer, a guaranteed personality. I'm all tuned in, I see all the programs, I save coupons for packets of tea. I've got my giant hit discotheque album. I empty a bottle, I feel a bit free. Kids in halls and the pipes in the walls make me noises for company. Long distance callers make long distance calls, and the silence makes me lonely. I'm lost in the supermarket. I can no longer shop happily. I came in here for a special offer, a guaranteed personality. It's not here. In the supermarket, I can no longer shop happily. I came in here for the special offer, guaranteed personality. I'm all lost in the supermarket. I can no longer shop happily. I came in here for the special offer, guaranteed personality. I'm all lost.
That is The Clash wrapping up Rewind today, Lost in the Supermarket. Thanks so much for reminiscing with us this week. Our question of the week was, what do you remember from grocery stores from you were young? Check out our story at KAXE.org with responses and a pretty cool photo of one of our listeners with a Piggly Wiggly mascot. I'm Jennifer Barr. You've been listening to KAXE Rewind. You can start thinking about next week's question of the week. We want to hear about what libraries mean to you or have meant to you throughout your life. You can text in 218-326-1234. We'll officially kick that off Monday morning, but we'd love to hear from you anytime. Text us 218-326-1234. Thanks for listening to Rewind on People Powered KAXE.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Minnesota Mixtape is our deep dive into the local music scene, Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at 3 p.m. with host Malachi Coons. Now it's time for Weekend Edition here on KAXE.